Hi, I'm Kate.
And I'm Lori. We've always thought that the most compelling story strikes the perfect balance between an honest look at the mess of life and the humor that can be found in the mess. To be perfectly honest, we don't really know how to live life without both the humor and the authenticity.
Our podcast might be a little bit of whiplash at times. We can spin from hard and deep to humor and laughing on a dime. The hard will be really hard, and the truths we share are the ugliest of humanity. We don't intend to make it seem like it's all fine or to pretty up the pain, but we also know that the joy we found is all the more profound because of the pain.
So we hope you can stick with us through the ugly, because there will also be joy and hope and humor. Welcome to The Ugly Truth About the Girl Next Door.
Hey, welcome back to our podcast. Just Kate today. I just want to give a quick intro before you listen to the episode that you're about to listen to. Today I am in this episode talking to my father-in-law, John Gannon. Him and my husband's family were longtime chapel members. He was a board member at the chapel, a volunteer, and then ultimately at one point a staff member as well. In this episode, he gives a ton of really awesome insight into kind of both the internal workings of the chapel and his view on that, as well as kind of his view of what should have been done, what needs to be done as we have walked through this journey with the chapel, and also his insights just as a dad, you know, as he is hearing this information from me, his daughter-in-law, and from his son, my husband and our family, and walking alongside us in that. So listen carefully. We have a really good conversation about a lot of the different things, and he gives a lot of really great insights. So have a listen. Again, thank you so much for listening, and just remember to like us on Instagram, share the podcast. And I think I say this at the end of the episode, but, you know, voice your opinion as well, right? We want to hear from you. We want the chapel to hear from you. So please go ahead and voice your opinion as well. All right. Thanks. Have a listen.
Stop. Okay, all right. Great. Welcome back to our podcast, The Ugly Truth About the Girl Next Door. I'm Kate, and today I'm recording without Lori. And actually, I'm talking today with my father-in-law, John Gannon. So, Dad, you have been a chapel member for a long time. You are also my father-in-law. And you were a volunteer, a board member, and also a staff member at the end. So can you just really quickly give us a high level, like when you guys started going to the chapel, how long you were there, and kind of your different roles in that time period?
Certainly. Let me let you know, Kate, that we started, we were at the chapel, when we left last July for, 19 years. We had connected and started volunteering at the outset, joined the chapel in 2008. So we're chapel members for 14 of those 19 years. And we're connected, as you said, in many ways throughout the chapel. Certainly our time, talent, and treasure look to live sacrificially and to follow, obviously, the teaching that we hear from Scripture in terms of how we lived our life and how we gave back in line with what God calls us to. So let me do this. Let me jump into what I try to do is, and I'll share with you kind of some, as a dad, some of the emotions that I've gone through. So I would say that the first topic or the first, you know, emotion I would say is a brokenness. And I just want to say that earlier this month, I shared with the chapel board that as a dad, I'm broken for the atrocities that Kate has endured and for the public sharing that her and Patrick have decided to pursue in order to expose the darkness and continue to heal their lives, right? My wife and I, Janet and I, we have stated since the outset that we 100% are united with the truth that Kate and Patrick have revealed. I've repeatedly said that the courage and conviction that Kate has displayed, I desire to see that consistently in my own life. As a dad, I would say, Kate, one of the aspects at the outset is a feeling of brokenness. I would say the next that I kind of process through is disgust. And what I mean by that is for the manner in which your abusers have violated you, and for the sickness of tying this to the church and tying this to God, manipulating and brainwashing a young child, telling you that you'd be left alone, not believed, not loved. I think for me, their wickedness is, and their deceit is just gut-wrenching. I just, it's hard for me to fathom and understand that kind of mindset and that behavior. The next I would say is unbelief. And this really kind of goes to the church. Not that I lack faith, that's not it at all, but unbelief by the church allowing this to continue once it was revealed, right? I believe their failure for not standing by Kate as a victim is mind-boggling to me. And proclaiming that as disciples were to seek and stand for the truth, while the church's actions have, in my opinion, missed the mark, right? Clearly. And then the last I would say, Kate, is as the dad, is hope. For God is on the throne and he will not be mocked. We know that the abusers and others who have participated in this unspeakable crime will be rightly judged by him at the due time. So that's what I would say kind of is my initial kind of reaction as a dad and processing through this with yourself and with Patrick and just with our family.
Run the gamut of emotions that you guys have had to experience walking in this with us. Like I said, not something that you guys have ever really had to come face to face with. And then suddenly being thrown into this, you know, thank you so much for, like I said, I have amazing in-laws. So really sad.
Thank you. Well, I would say just in return, right? And I know I've said this to you and to our daughter-in-law, Jess, as well. I mean, for mom and I, we have, you know, certainly you as our daughter-in-law, Jess as our daughter-in-law, but we truly see you and embrace you guys as our daughters, right? And so, you know, the impact that you've had in our family, the impact in our lives, through our sons and through your children, and just through your gifting and how God has designed you, has been a true blessing to our family that we're forever grateful for.
Well, thank you. I do know this, that you guys feel that way. So thank you. Okay. Moving on to the church piece. So as you said, you know, you were a staff member, a volunteer, you were, a board member for a long time. So talk to me about kind of watching this whole thing unfold in this church that you loved for so long.
Yeah, thank you for that. So I would, again, in kind of consistency in terms of, I picked some kind of feelings, emotions, you know, the first I'd say is sadness from a church perspective for the manner in which this horrific abuse and trafficking began in the church and was allowed to flourish by those appearing as holy and righteous, but being, in my view, less than human, right? And so I know that's a fairly salty statement, I guess, is what you and Lori would say.
That's fine.
but that's exactly how I feel. I think the next emotion is, from a church perspective, is disappointment. And let me just expound upon that for a moment. So, that the chapel has failed to act and stand with you and Patrick and Lori and our family. And it brings to mind, to whom much is given, much is required, which I believe in my processing through this and looking forward, I believe it leads to a need for true accountability within the chapel, within the church. failing to commit to stand with the truth that you've shared, allowing your complicit abuser to remain in a lay counseling role for almost a year and a half, I believe needs to result in consequences and change. I don't see any other way. And so I would just, to further kind of clarify that, I believe this involves leadership at all levels, the counseling pastor, the co-executive pastors, and the lead pastor. Mm-hmm. And let me just, if I could, kind of give you my perspective, because again, I was not in-house for all of Circle C, certainly was for what you've raised here. But this is how I see the chapel having acted. And again, this is my perspective that I'm sharing. But they look to, when something like this gets brought to them, it's like chaos, and they try to navigate through a maze to come out to, you know, kind of a decision or determination. And I think that that has probably a link into what happened with Circle C and the women that came forward there. But mm-hmm. I think the chapel, bottom line, continues to fail victims. And to me, that's not acceptable. And that's why I'll point to the accountability, the need for consequences, and the need for change. In my opinion, Kate, I would say, there needs to be independent counsel with experience in sexual abuse and trafficking. And it's ironic that we know this week that Ministry Safe is on DCX, and right. Diane Langberg was in a couple weeks ago. And those are two places that I would point the chapel to, is you need to deal with somebody like a Ministry Safe organization that has the understanding legally and has done this for three decades, I believe. Right. And then I would also say that there must be a partnership in place to engage with a firm equipped in sexual abuse trauma expertise. And I don't know if Diane Langberg is that person or her firm, but that would certainly be an ideal starting place. Right. Let me say this. The summary for me is repeating a check internal investigation as they navigate this maze that I reference, followed by a staff congregational statement to endeavor to have learned and perform better the next time, should never, ever be given consideration again. I just think that that is, we know this is going to come about again, as sad as that is. And for them to continue to go through this reactionary, we're trying to make our way through the maze, it's not for lack of effort. It's just the fact that I think they're completely off base as to how to go about and how to deal with this type of issue.
Right. No, I agree with you. Absolutely. And yeah, we've said this, you know, sadly, I'm not the first, nor will I be the last. And unfortunately, there's a whole trail of victims and people behind me who have had just shockingly similar experiences with, you know, trying to disclose at the chapel. So yeah, I'm with you there for sure.
The other thing I would say is just, and again, I've shared this with you and Patrick, I've shared this with the executive pastor that I reported to, with the lead pastor, that the abuse in your story, it's true and it happened, right? There's no other qualification needed. I think at times people kind of feel like, well, you know, it happened, but it didn't happen in our church, or it happened, but it was so long ago, or it happened and it's really unfortunate. One last point I would just make real quickly, Kate, is that, you know, I see as the church that the church is called to stand in the gap. And I said this to leadership, you know, for those who are marginalized, for those who are abused, for those who have been silenced and shamed, taken advantage of, for the widow, for the orphan, you can go on and on and on with the list, right? This must define who we are. And I said, you know, I shared with the executive pastor and the lead pastor that if it's about our programming, our strategies, our leadership intensives, our discipleship pathways, our launching of new campus initiatives and things of that nature, that cannot, absolutely cannot supersede our call to stand with victims among us, which is certainly your scenario. And as you said, the Circle C women, when they came forward, and there's a litany before that as well.
Absolutely. Yep. Yeah. And that's kind of what, you know, victims who I've spoken to, people that have come to the chapel before have said, you know, it's become very clear to me that, that they err on the side of protecting the institution and not the, the victims, unfortunately. And as you know, this is Lori and I's like repeated, like whatever, is that you always err on the side of defending, protecting, standing with the victim. You can always walk that back. But, and I think, Dad, it was you that shared with me actually from the Diane Langberg thing, that in 50 years of her practice, of her, you know, walking through abuse scenarios and mediating that, only two times has it been an untrue disclosure. And both scenarios, there was a reason for it. Like Lori said in her one, you know, How I Know episode, there was, it was like a messy divorce situation, or, you know, one parent pitting another one against them, things like that. But in 50 years of practice, Diane Langberg says only two times did she ever come across an abuse disclosure that was untrue. Yes. So, I mean, yeah, just that statistic alone. Okay, so going back in time, can you just quickly talk about, you know, Patrick and I and Lori sat down with you guys. We had had this meeting in 2019 with my abusers. We tried to set some limits. And we felt like we needed to kind of, you know, it took me some time, obviously, working with Lori to even come to this term of trafficking. You know, I'm telling her all these details, telling her all these things. And, she's looking at me like, do you know what this is called? So, you know, then kind of having to loop you guys into that and just telling you, you know, hey, we're going to need some support in this. And also, by the way, this is what we're walking through, and wanting to share that with you guys. Can you just tell me quickly, like, how that felt for you and Mom, having to be in that meeting with us, I guess?
Well, I'll never forget it, Kate, right? I remember being at your house with you and Patrick and Lori and Mom and I, right? And I remember the first thing I think that flashed through my mind was that these abusers will do whatever it takes to ensure is never revealed, right? I think it started when you shared what you shared and Lori shared and Patrick shared, you know, pieces of the puzzle. I guess I use that analogy. I know you and Lori have used that, but pieces of the puzzle regarding your abusers and others, which never made sense up until that point in time, suddenly kind of came into focus, right? And so it's hard for me to, just in terms of, and again, in your story, you are so articulate in how you shared how people who perpetrate this type of evil and wickedness, how they operate. And as you were telling us and sharing with us, there were things that I could point to in my mind as to, I can check this box, I can check this box, I can check this box. So right. I feel as if that was something that when you share that, that was the other thing. And then I think the final thing was really, how do we, you know, myself and Mom and our family, how do we protect and secure, you know, your safety and the safety of your family, right? Because you were coming out, obviously going to be sharing this coming out of that discussion. So that was certainly a concern that we had as well.
Right, right. Yep, absolutely. Yeah, I remember that conversation too. I remember feeling, and I think I've shared this in the podcast earlier, but I remember feeling terrified, like they are, the lies that they've always fed to me are going to be true. Like, this is where I lose, you know, my in-law family. This is maybe where I lose Patrick. This is, you know, this is that moment in time. This is where it all falls apart. And Lori just kept saying, you know, that's not going to happen. These are not, you know, these people are not them. These people are good people who can wrap their minds around this and who they know. Lori says to me all the time, the Gannons know how to love well. And that's true. And I, you know, I said last week in the episode that the support that I've received, even just in doing the podcast, is kind of undoing some of those lies for me. And this meeting with you and Mom was kind of a first step in that, that, you know, I said my truth out loud and you guys didn't run away. You didn't look at me in disgust and think, oh my God, our poor son married this lunatic. you know?
No, not at all. And even, Kate, when you first started seeing Lori, I know Patrick had come and spoke to Mom and I, and we just said, listen, whatever you need, right? Whether it was babysitting, whatever you need, right? Obviously before the November 19th meeting, but when you started seeing Lori back in 17, 18, I remember Patrick saying, we may need some help. And we were like, and again, we didn't know everything, but we were like, listen, whatever you need, as I said, we think of you, Kate, as our daughter, right? And so you're our family. And so we absolutely stand. And I've said this to the chapel folks, I've said it to anybody who I've talked to, is that we 100% stand united with you and your story and your truth. And there is no, you know, doubt in our mind with respect to what you've shared.
Yeah. Thank you for that. And I think it's important because, like I said, you guys are not, you know, it's one thing for Lori, who's been steeped in this type of trauma for 30 plus years in her career, but that hasn't been the case for you guys. You guys are regular, you know, like I keep saying, you're a bunch of accountants. So, you know, but this is not something that it was like, oh, okay, that makes sense. It took a minute, and yet it didn't take a minute. It was like, absolutely, we believe you. So I think it's just important to point that out, because a lot of people listening to us are not trauma informed necessarily, are not trauma therapists like Lori. They're regular people who are like, oh my goodness, like this is a lot to take in, and yet I believe it.
And let me say this, when I resigned from the chapel, one of the things that I did is, having been in the board role not that long before, one of the things that I said to both the executive pastor I reported to, as well as the lead pastor, is I was going to share my resignation letter with the board. The reason I did that is really twofold, right? One, my concern was that the board may likely not receive the rationale as to why I resigned. That may not be communicated to them as outlined in my resignation letter. And I also sent an email to the board with my resignation letter. And I said, you know, I feel compelled to provide my assessment for the board for consideration of needed changes within and across the organization on the topics profiled. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure whether or not that resulted in any additional traction or further evaluation by the leadership or by the board, but in my opinion, it should have, right? The other thing that I would say is, the executive pastor had come back to me when I said I was going to share that with the board and said to me, well, I just want you to know that the board is not aware of all the details related to Kate's story. And I would say a more transparent view I came to learn about after the fact was that the board was not aware at all of your story. Mm-hmm. And, which had initially been raised to the chapel leadership, as we've talked about, a year and a half earlier, right?
Right.
And so, you know, some of the things that, you know, Lori had talked about, just a fiduciary responsibility. Some of this information, I think, Kate, was just not shared. I think that happened during my time and tenure on the board. This was a clear example of, this was going on for a year and a half when you guys had gone to the chapel, and yet, my resignation letter for people on that board, aside from one, was the first time they had heard about this issue.
Mm-hmm.
And that just, to me, is how can that be, right? I mean, how was that not shared prior to that point in time?
Remember, though, would you have expected that it would have been shared with the board? Like, is that something that should have been shared with the board?
I believe it should have been, but again, I believe that the role, you know, although it was financial, fiduciary in nature, mm-hmm. there were a number of other topics shared, but I think, and again, this comes to accountability and consequences and change. Mm-hmm. I think there are things that should have been shared with the board that likely were not shared. And I've got another example that I can talk to very quickly, that just before I was leaving, the executive pastor had asked me to look into some things regarding an investment opportunity. And I kind of said, well, I'm not really that familiar. I'm going to have to do some homework on that. I'm not certain about the optics of this, but net, he wanted to proceed forward. And I said to him, you need to, in my view, you need to run this by the board. Now, again, if I didn't have the inside view, Kate, I would not have been aware of that. And the board, I don't believe, was aware of it. And what happened, as I left, it hadn't been put before the board, but there was a turnover document that I documented everything, all my projects in process. And I heard after the fact that this was put before the board, and the board came back and said, no, we're not in favor of doing that. I personally, this is just my opinion, I believe that that would not have been put before the board, and the decision would have been made, and they would have proceeded forward with kind of a decision made solely by the executive pastor. And I just don't think that that is proper process. I don't think it's proper protocol. I don't think it's healthy in terms of that type of setup.
No, I mean, this is kind of what we had pointed out in one of our last episodes was, you know, if the board is not responsible for holding the leadership, the lead pastor, the executive pastors accountable, then who is, right? So whether or not the board is aware of that responsibility, I guess, or not, like Lori said, there's either a problem with the setup of the church and that they're not, that's not their responsibility, or there's a problem in that they're just not, they're being shielded from that responsibility.
Yes, and I would say, I'm sorry, Kate, just to interject, I would say, at least in a couple of examples that I brought up, I think it was more about non-disclosure from
leadership,
executive pastor and leadership to the board, than it was about the board kind of not having that in their purview of responsibility. That's my perspective that I would share.
Right. But so now that it has been brought to the attention of the board, it's fair to say that they should now be able to step in, correct?
In my opinion, Kate, I believe at this point the board needs to assert itself. And it needs to be the catalyst for the accountability, the consequence, and the change that I referenced earlier, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm praying and hoping that they will have a voice that will be heard, and that the board will sit down, review this in its entirety, and come out and do the necessary things that we've talked about regarding accountability, change, and consequence management. You know, being on staff, I was there for a year. I said to, the executive pastor and to the lead pastor before I left that I believe that the organization, again, this probably goes back to the board, because the leadership has not developed. In my opinion, we have two executive pastors in the chapel trying to micromanage the organization from an executive pastor level. And I stated to them that I don't believe that that is sustainable. I don't believe it. I think it'll fail at some point. Right. So that was kind of, that was kind of my assessment. I wanted to do a bunch of different things in terms of changing things, developing leaders. And I think that there was a position where they just didn't feel as if this was the time to do it. So my comment was, well, I didn't come here to just kind of maintain the status quo, to tread water. I came here to try to make a difference and to make change for the good of the chapel and for the good of the kingdom. That was my heart. Certainly not perfectly, but that was my heart. And if you didn't want to do that, then, then I was likely going to look for another opportunity outside the chapel. Yeah, and I just think the opportunity there, Kate, was so great that and again, this is where I will tie this back to, developing leaders. If the board should be intently aware of, who's going into a leadership role and, maybe even part of the vetting process. We've never done that, in my view. We have just entrusted, and I'm not saying that they're not capable. I'm not saying that they haven't tried their level best, but just entrusted that to the leadership. And I believe that the board should, I believe, quite frankly, Kate, that there are a lot of people that have left the chapel on staff. There are exit interviews done on every person that leaves. And I had my exit interview with HR, and I had my resignation letter, which she had seen as to why I was leaving. We went through that. But I believe that the board should get a chance to take a look at kind of exit interviews and find out what are the recurring themes, and is there some sort of kind of pattern that we need to be aware of and be mindful of and how we do what we do going forward, right? I just believe, you know, we should always be in a position as lifelong learners, never having felt as if we've arrived and we know it all. And so, you know, those are some of the things that I think that, you know, no organization is perfect. I recognize that. But right, there's a lot I think that can be improved and enhanced with respect to the chapel team.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I have been on staff in a ministry setting. And you and I have talked about this, you know, at length. Yeah, it's not set up correctly.
Yeah.
And it certainly has its difficulties. You know, I've shared this with you, you know, being on staff at Harvest House and you know, my role there, it has its difficulties because it is a ministry and because it lends itself to, you know, it's not that cutthroat corporate world that, you know, that maybe you were used to, but there has to be an element of accountability that I think is just really lacking. So all of that being said, you know, Dad, obviously you've been a volunteer, you've been a board member, you've been a staff member. You guys have loved this church for so long, loved your, you know, being engaged as a volunteer, as you said, that was, you know, something that you really, that was your heart passion. And that was amazing. So now how, as you watch this unfold and as you, you know, are disappointed and frustrated and all the things, how do you reconcile for yourself that this church that you loved, is kind of has collapsed in this, you know, in this realm and in this specific area, yeah, of not supporting victims, as you hear, you know, Lori and I talk about it. And as you and I talk about it, how do you reconcile that for yourself?
Yeah, it's a great question, Kate. I mean, for me, you know, I think for Janet and I, we've said, listen, we're submitted and trying to be obedient to God. Right. And so we made the decision to step away because we've said, we believe your truth 100%. We stand united with you and Patrick and Lori, right? And so, you know, I would do the same. We would do the same again. If the circumstances presented themselves, we would do the very same thing again. Has it been hard to step away? Absolutely. Yep. But we know beyond the shadow of a doubt that we did the right thing. Mm-hmm. I just believe that God had me there for just this season. And right, and although it was shorter than I would have hoped it would have been, it was a year. It was my decision to step away, and I don't regret it, and I wouldn't change it going forward. But I believe that that it was His ordaining my opportunity to be there so that I could provide the support and some of the, again, the view of accountability, consequence, and changes that are needed within the chapel organization.
And kind of this idea that Lori and I keep talking about of, you know, I have all the support in the world. I have an incredible in-law family. I have an incredible husband. I have Lori who is supporting me. When we came to the chapel back in, you know, 2020, when we came to the pastor, the counseling pastor, we had all of the resources at our disposal. So I would like to hear your thoughts on the idea that if I can't come forward in the chapel with all of that, all of the resources and the support, who can, right? How did it take me having to go public with this information to finally get someone to listen? And if someone didn't have all these resources, how on earth would they be able to come forward?
As I noted earlier, without change, without accountability, and without that culminating in consequences, I believe is the only answer, right?
Right.
There's got to be fundamental change. Again, having another chapel-sponsored internal investigation, that ought never see the light of day again, right? They hopefully would never head down that path again. But I think there's got to be that aspect of accountability, change, and consequence. And in my view, in our view, I would say our family's view, Janet, myself, any other outcome would be an inadequate response from our perspective, right? I think trying to do anything other than address this, recognize where the failings were, and correct it moving forward so that we know, as you said, there is going to be a next person, another person, somebody that's coming. and for this to continue to be the way that this church, who has, you know, stood for Christ and has been a light for Christ, for them to operate and conduct this way is, to me, just completely, it's inadequate and has to change.
Yeah.
And I would agree, Kate, and I would hope, as you said, with the people that are listening, that are engaged at the chapel, that they have a voice as well. They have, mm-hmm. they have an opportunity to be heard, right? This is something that certainly the pastors, and I absolutely agree, and I've been praying for them and praying for this meeting that's coming up. But there are people who are, and you've heard some of these people come back in and say, until this gets addressed, we're stepping back from service. We're stepping back from supporting the chapel. There are people out there that I believe need to, you know, to have their voice heard, right? Because that's what it's going to take in order for the change and the consequence and the accountability to take hold, I believe.
Right. Absolutely. I know Lori and I keep joking and it's not funny, but you know how we do. It's like a call to the senator kind of situation, right? Email your pastor, email, you know, the lead pastor, email, call whoever you need to call. But I think you're right. It does take more than one voice to affect change. So I think that's kind of, that's what we're hopeful for. All right. Thank you so much, Dad. You are the best. So,
well, Kate, thanks for having me on. And again, continuing to pray for the circumstance and for what's next. You guys are doing a phenomenal job.
Thank you.
We love you and Patrick and your family and Lori and her family. And again, are just so honored to be able to stand in support of your truth and for the way you're articulating this day in and day out. And the fact of the matter is that you and Lori have not allowed yourselves to be silenced, right? That you continue to push, continue to look at other options and alternatives in order to be able to get this to take hold. And my hope and prayer is that the chapel listens, the board listens, and that there is an opportunity for folks to stand up for truth and for what's right and do what the church is called to do.
If you or someone you know is stuck in a trafficking situation and needs help, please reach out to the National Human Trafficking Hotline by calling 1-888-373-7888 or text HELP, H-E-L-P, to 233-733.